You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite the changes in Washington, many Americans are pessimistic about whether we can retain our role as the world's economic and political leader. Thomas PM Barnett is one of the optimists. In his new book, Great Powers, America and the World After Bush, Dr. Barnett analyzes the challenges the Obama administration will face and details the strategies it will need to employ to be successful in this century of rapid globalization. The book is published by Putnam, and Dr. Barnett joins me now. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me on.
You write that America's grand strategy is off track because it's not in sync with globalization's current trajectory. What do you mean by that?
Well, we got so fixated. If you think of globalization as a bell curve, we got so fixated on sort of baseline security issues, terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and we got so fixated on top-line political achievements, accelerated democracy, that we sort of lost track of this vast middle territory, which is the global economy expanding very dramatically over the last 20 years, you know, adding about half the world's population very quickly, lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, on that basis creating demands for resources that were astronomical. So, you know, we're looking at, in the next 20 years, adding about a billion people to the planet, but we're looking at adding about 2 billion to a global middle class.
So you're saying we got sidetracked with the war on terror.
I'm saying it diverted our attention from the dynamics that are really changing the structure of the world. I mean, terrorism doesn't rule anything, and pretending like terrorism is the, you know, they're driving the planet. I mean, it's been a pretty good global economy the last 7 years, if they have.
Although former Vice President Cheney predicted yesterday that we're going to see a new terrorist attack because we have a new administration.
Well, we're always going to be under that sort of threat. But, you know, the rest of the world has dealt with terrorism to a degree that we just are completely unfamiliar with. We have this one big event in New York and Washington on 9/11 and in 2001, but I mean, and India has suffered Mumbai-like attacks at a regular frequency. So we rejoin the world on this basis. But you know, my fear has been with the Bush administration, and my concern with an Obama one is you can't get wrapped around that axle because it really blinds you to the big changes, and it makes it harder for you to find friends where you need friends.
But you also write that the United States, despite these recent failures, should remain the globe's leader. Don't we see some pretty good leadership from other parts of the world?
Well, leadership is not control. Okay, leadership is often by example. So, you know, it's not that America is in charge of globalization. I say globalization comes with rules, not a ruler. And there are definitely numbers of rising great powers around the planet. That's why I named the book Great Powers. And there's a clear...
With an S.
With an S. And it's clear that we have to partner a lot more with these rising great powers because they have the instincts for the kind of frontier integration activity that's required in a global economy that's expanded so quickly into a lot of low-trust environments.
And one of those great powers is China. Today, people find little positive to say about the Bush years. And although you're quite critical of it, you also detail a number of significant Bush administration accomplishments. And one involves China?
Well, you know, I think 100 years from now, historians will look back on the Iraq War like looking at the Brits with the Boer War in 1905. It's not going to be the story of this time frame. The story of this time frame is definitely China's rise. And for 8 years, Bush did not mess that up. He didn't pick any stupid fights. It really says something to an Obama administration, which is, you know, casually accusing China of manipulating currency when, by golly, they're going to have to finance our trillion-dollar deficits. And I don't talk that way to my banker.
So we didn't pick fights because China is just too important to us economically. It's a major source of our imports, but also the Chinese hold huge amounts of U.S. Treasury notes.
Right.
And it would be silly to consider a serious confrontation. But doesn't that weaken the U.S.'s position vis-a-vis China? We can't push too hard?
It means we have to be patient. I mean, their economic development, by many accounts, objective analysis says they're moving towards a model of big firms surrounded by a sea of entrepreneurial small firms. I mean, that's sort of the American model. Are they ruled by a single-party state? Sure. You know, I'll run you through the first 50 years of American history after the Declaration of Independence, and we were pretty much ruled by, you know, one party, replaced by another one party for quite some time. So when I look at countries post-revolution, post-inauguration of their modern form, it's about a 50-year journey to pluralism.
So you're not one of those people who feels that China will be the United States' next big opponent. Do you think it'll be our next big ally?
I do.
You've blogged that recently.
I do. I think the choice for us with the Chinese is much like the Brits at the beginning of the 20th century. They could see that their economic dominance was setting, and yet they wanted to be able to punch at their weight in terms of military. And we're already overdrawn with two relatively small interventions, you could argue, in historical terms, Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet look at the foreign policy since the tie-down became apparent. Everywhere we go, we ask for China's help. Zimbabwe, Namibia, Iran, Iraq.
And China doesn't come through for us.
No.
Sudan, for example.
Right. China is America maybe 1870. They know that their economic interests are exploding around the planet. They're very nervous about sticking their necks out. And part of that is our problem, because every time they do anything in the direction of assuming a role, then we say, hey, what's that up? You know, what are you doing becoming interested in the Persian Gulf? Mm-hmm. Well, most of their oil comes from the Persian Gulf, a lot more than our oil comes from the Persian Gulf.
Actually, there was an article in Today's Times that suggests that we may find some kind of accommodation with China in dealing with global warming.
I think we will, but, you know, one of the compromises I talk about in the book is that, you know, we've achieved a middle-class existence. We look at a big chunk of the world striving for that over the next 20 years, and all of a sudden pulling out global warming and saying, oh, by the way, you're going to have to do it in a super clean fashion. We didn't. In fact, we caused this problem. But you, my friend, need to do this in a super clean fashion. Otherwise, we're going to kneecap you every chance we get in terms of your economic rise. You can't make that your pitch. You got to really go for the here's your opportunity to leapfrog over technologies. And the Chinese think along those lines. And I argue that you want hybrids, for example, you want hydrogen cars. You're going to get them in China before you get them in America, because they're going to quintuple their car market in the next 20 years. And if you've ever been to China, I mean, I take antibiotics the minute my plane lands, because I get a sinus infection about 3 minutes in from the air pollution. There's just no way they can do it on air pollution alone.
Of course, there's a good chance that those antibiotics were manufactured in China.
Another issue. I mean, they have product control liability issues that are kind of profound. But, you know, you go back and look at the milk scandals we had in America, like China just had, 1850s, 1860s, same kind of stuff. You know, a sectional economy coming together as a continental-wide economy. And there was a lot of anger expressed at the bad way capitalism was treating consumers and labor in that time frame. So I say, you know, bring on the noise, populism, bring on the funk, progressivism. It comes in that order. We're replicating that journey that America took in the late 19th century, now on a global scale.
My guest is Thomas P.M. Barnett, whose latest book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush, published by Putnam, follow-up to his best-selling The Pentagon's New Map, which brought you here a few years back.
2004.
But that looked at the military side of the equation. Here you're talking about the economic one, and you mentioned the middle class. You're saying also that the world is missing a sense of a worldwide middle class. You think that if everybody had middle class values, then everything would be okay? Aren't there many people in countries like Iran, for example, leaders anyway,
right,
who say that this is everything that's bad about America? It's the what leads to American hegemony?
Well, it certainly leads to consumerism, and consumerism typically leads to more independence of thought and more desire for responsiveness from your government. And in an Iran that's dominated by a theocracy, that means less power for the theocracy itself, so I'm sure they feel threatened by it. But, I mean, I make the example of looking at the American Reconstruction after the Civil War. There was the assumption that it was the victorious North that was going to reconstruct the prostrate South, when in reality it was an industrialized East that was integrating a Wild West. Okay, and that's where we find the Western ideal, the Western man that we love politically, who comes in and cleans up Washington on a regular basis. That's where we located that middle class ideology. That's been the political lubricant of our system. I think we're going through the similar kind of dynamics now with the world.
But hasn't the South won the Civil War, at least if you look at American politics over the last 40, 50 years?
Well, they certainly operate our military still. I mean, most military officers of note tend to come from south of Mason-Dixon. Ultimately, you lose your identity in that integration process. And we're losing our identity to a certain extent when the East and West come together and integrate the South, where you're going to find most of those middle class coming out of.
Now, after 9/11, the United States enjoyed an awful lot of support around the world. It's been said we lost it all by invading Iraq. How would you characterize America's standing in the world after the Bush administration?
I don't think we lost it all by invading Iraq. I think we lost it.
And Abu Ghraib and torture.
We lost it by doing the post-war terribly. I mean, if we had done the post-war well and we had gotten, say, to this point, you know, in the 2005 timeframe, this lower level of violence, this level of political stability, then it would have been seen as a huge success. But when you drag it out for 4 or 5 years and look willfully stubborn on making the changes you need to make in your tactics, then people suspect you have ulterior motives, and that really destroys your credibility.
And you write that the major loss of status is irreversible. It cannot be reversed even as it is redirected.
It has to be redefined, is my argument. I mean, we have to realize that, for example, a quorum of NATO and Japan does not equal a quorum for great power answers for the world today. Even the Europeans don't look at it like that. And yet it is our tendency, based on the age of our leadership, to assume our only friends really are Westerners.
Well, didn't we gain a lot of goodwill around the world when Barack Obama was elected president? And in some countries like France went through a bit of soul searching to try to find out why they aren't doing as well as we have.
They miss us when we go on a bender. It makes them very nervous because they really do look at us like the leader of globalization. And indeed, that's a central argument of my book. We are its DNA, its source code. I mean, our model of states uniting, economies integrating, collective security, a competitive religious landscape, high transaction network growth, that is America. And we've been projecting that around the planet. So they look at us as a model, as sort of the, you know, not the guys who call all the shots, but somebody who's more experienced at this than them, so that when we go off on a bender and propose new rules that they find very advantageous to us maybe and not to them, then they wonder about our motives and they get really nervous. So Obama signals hopefully a move back towards the middle.
Well, how long will that goodwill last if things don't change a lot?
Well, I think he's guaranteed to spend this first term basically unwinding several aspects of the Bush administration. And I think as long as he's moving in that direction, goodwill remains.
It's been predicted that China will have the largest middle class in the world by the year 2025.
Right.
China has, at this point, 1.5 billion people. So what does having the largest middle class mean? Won't that still be a teeny proportion of the total population?
Well, you know, if we were China, we'd have everybody in the Western Hemisphere plus, say, the bottom half of Africa living inside our borders. I mean, we'd have that many rich people, that many middle-class people. It'd be sizable. I mean, it would still be a huge demand function in the global economy. But you'd have, like, you know, 600-700 million poor people living on less than a dollar a day inside America. That's hard for people to imagine. You say almost 1.5 billion. I'll tell you, China's the same size geographically as the United States with the same concentration of population on the coasts. So, you know, I always say, you know, go to a major sporting event, see what it's like when you're walking out just after the last whistle's blown. That's China 24/7. And that's hard to imagine for people.
My guest is Thomas P.M. Barnett, who regularly advises the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the State Department, the Special Operations Command, Pacific Command, Central Command, briefs senior members of the four military services in the intelligence community, Congress, and global corporations. He's now the senior managing director of Intera Solutions, and he has written a new book called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. It's published by Putnam. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Thomas P.M. Barnett, whose latest book is Great Powers, America and the World After Bush, published by Putnam. You've outlined a 12-step recovery program. This is kind of like AA for America, a program that you believe America needs to adopt to get back on track with its foreign policy. Do you think President Obama is likely to make many of these steps?
you know, I think the environment is sending so many signals to him to make these steps. And what impresses me about him is that he's such a systems-level thinker. I mean, the guy really views the world more horizontally than vertically. He sees the connections across domains, across regions, across sectors of economies, and he's the kind of guy who thinks through secondary and tertiary order effects. So, yeah, I think he's very receptive to this kind of messaging.
What we seem to be obsessing on is whether he should admit to making mistakes or not. Is that part of the thing that bogs America down?
Well, you know, George Bush was sort of famous for giving off this vibe of, you know, I may not always get things right, but I never get them wrong. And people were tired of that because he proposed such a drastic, in some ways needed, rule set change after 9/11. There were certain things we really needed to tighten up very dramatically. But, you know, he was such a bad salesman in convincing people that these were rules that they wanted to follow. And when your rule set population is just you and you alone, that's not leadership.
Well, the reason I ask that is your eighth step, I'm jumping to your eighth step, recommends the making of a list of all the great powers whose national interests we have harmed and to become willing to make concessions to them all. The first concession, at least according to Iran, is apologize for everything that's gone wrong over the past 60 years, even things we've apologized for in the past, like our role in the overthrow of Mossadegh.
Right. Well, Iran's hardline leadership now needs to maintain its enemy image with the United States, very much so. I mean, Israel pretty much guarantees it on a regular basis with an incursion into Gaza or the West Bank or to southern Lebanon. But they really need us to remain an enemy, and they're pretty frightened by the prospect of an Obama administration, because if he's clever enough, he denies them an enemy. And he's moved in the direction of sort of de-escalating a lot of the rhetoric, becoming, you know, using the big boy voice of the world's sole superpower in military affairs. And they've already floated the notion, which I thought was brilliant, of extending our nuclear umbrella to Israel, which is just sort of a way of saying, you know, maybe I can't stop your reach for a nuclear device, but you know what? That puts you in the big boys club, and this is how we deal with big boys who do bad things. So we'll give you the same set of rules and instructions that we gave the Soviets over Western Europe. You make this kind of move, we may just liquidate your country.
Looking over these 12 steps, there are words like admit, humbly ask. And basically what you're saying is that the United States should start admitting that it doesn't have the kind of power over the way things are going to happen that we have suggested we had in the past, or did we have it in the past?
Well, we did, in the sense that, I mean, first half of the 20th century, 100 million dead across the Eurasian continent, massive wars that stretched from 1914 to 1949. I mean, just a lot of tumult, a lot of great power war. We step up, we take over a global system, 1945, that had operated under colonialization and empires, and we put our states uniting, economies integrating, international liberal trade order out there. First order of business, we have Europe and Japan outsource their security to us. We do the Marshall Plan. You know, 30, 40 years later, no thought of great power war with these countries. We do the same thing for Asia last 30 years. It certainly accumulates a lot of debt for us, but we've taken basically great power war off the table throughout Eurasia. That's an amazing accomplishment.
On the other hand, we engage in a number of wars in Asia, Korea, then Vietnam.
But none of them great power wars. None of them where we took on another great power. And this has been hard for us to contemplate, but we've basically waged wars for the system since, starting with Korea. Wars that were designed to create system stability, but were designed to purposely avoid taking on other great powers. And that's a role that we've latched onto. We're very comfortable with it in terms of executing it, but we're very uncomfortable with it sometimes in terms of the consequences of what it does with our relationships with other great powers.
Well, your first step is admitting that we are that we Americans are powerless over globalization. But don't we still have a fair amount of power over globalization? We control the IMF and the World Bank, which are two of the architects of globalization.
I like to say we have a lot of power in the face of globalization. There are things we can do to protect ourselves, and we certainly have to get better at protecting our middle class vis-a-vis the competition we're facing out there. But control over globalization, not really. I mean, it comes with rules, not a ruler. And it's been a problem of our success in spreading globalization that really has diminished our capacity to influence its direction in the same way that we have in the past, when it was basically our baby to nurture and protect.
We were too concerned about our own national interests. Is that why we didn't handle globalization well?
Well, I mean, again, I think we handled it pretty darn well in the 90s. We were a little naive on the assumptions that, you know, it wouldn't create security problems with this global economy, you know, rapidly heading into poorly connected, very traditional environments and creating a lot of social tumult and economic tumult. You know, that's going to bring violence. When you see that kind of integration process, frontier integration, there's violence attached to it. So we were naive in the 90s, and then we got, again, overly fixated on sort of the extremes, you know, kill all terrorists, democracy now, when the real major dynamic is, how the heck do I retain my cultural identity with this reformatting process called globalization, which I want. I want connectivity, I want rising income, but I want to retain my identity too.
Do you agree with Fareed Zakaria, who says we're in a post-American world?
I say we're heading towards a post-Caucasian world, but not a post-American world. I mean, America is heading towards a post-Caucasian world already.
But Europe has an awful lot of economic clout, doesn't it?
It does, but it's not the source of innovation that we are. It's not, although it's coming close more and more, it's not been historically the source of new rules for the system that we have been. You got to think of America as the original EU. We're the first multinational state on the planet. We have tremendous levels of connectivity and shared collective security and the integration process that they've been attempting for the last 20, 30 years. We've been doing it for 240 years. So we've been very well practiced at creating the rules that go with this. We don't recognize that as a skill set, but it's actually the biggest influence we have, how good we are at this kind of integration and how people copy our behavior.
And are we still doing that, or are we making a lot of poor decisions these days? Detroit is sure suffering from the decision to commit itself to the wrong kinds of automobiles.
Well, you know, globalization was a series of shifts sort of from Europe, where it kind of began in the 17th and 18th century, successfully replicated in a North America, then successfully replicated largely by a North America in terms of his example and influence and military efforts in a rising Asia. So, I mean, automobiles begin in France. They become mass-produced in America, and now that production center and demand center, not surprisingly, is shifting to Asia. So, I mean, do we want to hold on to these industries the same way we did in the middle of the 20th century, or should we really be focusing on genetics, bio, nano, the technologies of the future?
My guest is Thomas P.M. Barnett, whose latest book is Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. It's published by Scribner's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Part of the problem, it seems to me, you mentioned biotechnology and stem cell research has been a big issue in this country. A lot of scientists have left the country because of restrictions on it. How much have we been victims of ideology in any number of other areas as well in achieving the sorts of things that you're talking about?
That's a really good question because, you know, we were so used to being sort of the center of new rules in this global economy for so long that we assume if there are peculiarities for us, say on the basis of abortion or our view of human life, our view of human death, that if we go down a certain pathway, the rest of the world's going to respect that and not leap ahead or jump ahead of us on that question. Where you look at an Asia which has a different philosophical, religious, spiritual bent, where they're a little more comfortable, say, with reincarnation or, you know, other ideas about the repeatability of life, so that they're more willing to experiment with these pathways. We've seen that where we have been unable to test certain genetic efforts to cure cancer, where the Chinese will pick it right up. They'll do it, they'll perfect it, and then they come back over here and get a patent. You know, so that gives us a sense that we got to be a little more realistic about our social values and how we enclave ourselves, isolate ourselves, if we go down certain pathways that other countries aren't willing to go down and thus are willing to experiment more.
What impact does the recent economic downturn, both at home and abroad, have on your vision for America's foreign policy?
Well, it drives home the points I've been making for a long time, that we got to start moving beyond just the definition of the West as our friends I mean, demographically moribund countries that don't want to go anywhere and kill anybody. They got small militaries. They got declining defense budgets. They're not interested in doing the kind of patient frontier integration efforts that we are finding ourselves forced to do. And yet look at China and India. Their economic interests are expanding around the planet. They're getting very nervous. They show up for the Somali pirates incidents. Why? Because they're becoming more dependent on that kind of commerce. They have million-man armies. They've got lots of babies. They're having rising defense budgets. And yet we say to China, hey, you don't look like us enough politically. I don't see enough confluence of strategic interests. And we got to get past that because we are in a much tighter situation. We're going to have to retool domestically in terms of our economy. We're going to have to retool in terms of the way we spend and use our military. And along those lines now, we just are simply faced with the necessity of reaching out for allies that have the resources that can help us.
Do you think that that's likely with the new people who will be forming President Obama's foreign policy? Hillary Clinton, for example.
I'm concerned that this crew doesn't have much direct exposure to China. That worries me.
Well, Bush had Henry Kissinger as an advisor. He had plenty of exposure to China.
Oh, and he had a real vision for China.
But to some degree, that also led to some negative aspects, didn't it? Because he had there may have been conflict of interest. He was advising all sorts of things that would help him as somebody who worked with China.
Well, Nixon's decision to open China up is arguably the most important thing that's happened in globalization for the last 40, 50 years, because when Deng marketizes China, that creates a critical mass. All of a sudden, it's not just the West and this mini global economy. Now it's a truly global economy. Do we have people in the Obama administration who realize how crucial it is to keep China in that package now? I'm concerned they don't have a lot of exposure. I am made more sanguine by the fact that he has a non-Eurocentric sort of perspective himself.
What do you think about the situation in the Middle East and the appointment of special Middle East envoy George Mitchell? Can that problem ever be resolved? And does it matter whether it's George Bush or George Mitchell or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton or anybody else in the White House?
Let me give you a counterintuitive suggestion here. That Iran's achievement of nuclear status actually improves the chances for peace in the Middle East pretty dramatically. If we extend a nuclear umbrella to Israel and to neighboring Arab states that are Sunni states that are concerned about Iran having a nuclear capacity, then we move into a territory where you're going to find a lot of external great powers, much more dependent, for example, India and China, on Middle Eastern oil, and we are becoming very interested that there becomes some sort of regional security dialogue that recognizes this sort of strategic standoff and deals with it, not unlike what we did with detente, the SALT talks, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. We need an OSCE for the Middle East. We need a lot of these things. We're not getting them. Israel's monopoly of weapons of mass destruction in the region for 30, 40 years hasn't gotten it more safety. I mean, its military gets it more safety and its willingness to use it. So this joining of a single monopoly situation by a dyad situation, Iran reaching for the bomb and successfully pulling it off, I think actually gives us a lot of impetus to really focus on strategic regional issues.
The United States is closely watching the transfer of power in three countries with ailing autocratic leaders, Saudi Arabia, Cuba, and North Korea. Do you think we should be pushing those powers toward democracy? Can we push countries toward democracy?
Democracy, I say, is a dish best served cold. It comes with a large middle class. It tends to come with a middle-aging middle class. I mean, it's almost impossible, really young populations, not much income, to pull off democracy overnight. But do I think you're going to see guys running for president in Cuba within 10 years who run on a platform of making it the 51st state? Yeah, I do.
Really?
And I think you're going to see Miami Cubans basically holding any presidential candidate hostage all of a sudden to the notion of Cuba joining the United States as opposed to maintaining the embargo. So Cuba's a special situation because of its proximity. I think North Korea is a clear situation where we should anticipate the opportunity for a takedown when Kim Jong-il passes. I think the good news is the six-party talks between us and the Russians Japanese, South Koreans, and Chinese have basically obviated any sort of real danger of us going to war with each other over this situation.
Well, the recent economic downturn has hurt Vladimir Putin. So is he less of a threat than he might have been a couple of years ago?
Well, I say, you know, Putin is sort of an Andrew Jackson of Russia. You go back and look at Andrew Jackson, you know, he was running a young country with a lot of ambition, and he ruled it with a pretty autocratic hand. You know, had no problem with ethnic cleansing in Mississippi and Alabama, the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee. Why? He wanted access to land for cotton. Why? He wanted to make a great power on the basis of cotton. And he ruled in a very brutal, aggressive, economically nationalistic sense. And we're looking at a guy in Putin who's trying to do the same thing, basically with oil and gas. So is he taken down a peg or two with lower oil prices? Yeah. But, I mean, you got to realize this guy doesn't operate with any sort of ideology of expansionism in the old sense that we feared. It's very much Godfather logic. It is this is nothing personal. It's strictly business.
But also sphere of influence, because that protects his sense of safety and security.
Sure. And, you know, you got to recognize we've modeled some behavior. When my wife complains about my 13-year-old son's behavior, she always says, you know, where the hell do you think he got it? And then looks at me. We model some behavior in the Middle East the last 7 years. So Putin says, hey, I thought the deal was you don't like a small country. You declare its leader a war criminal. You invade. And, yeah, if there's a regional economic energy play, all the better. What's your problem with my smackdown of Georgia? I thought this is how we behave.
You're right that Africa, which has been largely ignored by the United States until recently, has a great deal of strategic importance. I would think it has a lot of importance in many different levels. Why have we ignored it? Is it because it's because of the turmoil that continues there?
Well, you know, commodity prices for raw materials for energy were pretty much depressed in the 1980s. Much of the 90s start to come back recently because that 3 billion new capitalist demand coming from the East wants everything. Okay, so all of a sudden, Africa becomes more important. People start to realize we get actually more oil from Africa than we do from the Persian Gulf. But the big push here, you know, it's not going to be the United States that integrates Africa. It sure as heck won't be Europe. It's going to be the Indians and the Chinese, because they're at that point on the production scale ladder where they naturally are looking for cheap labor, cheap raw materials. So what we did to an Asia and what a Europe did to us, say across the 19th century, what we did to an Asia in the 20th century, Asia will do to an Africa in the 21st century. The challenge for us is, although we don't have economic interests, we are concerned about how the Chinese interact with local governments.
Aren't the some Africans their own worst enemies? In Nigeria, for example, which is so oil-rich, the country could do a lot better if it could simply resolve its political strife.
Well, you know, anytime a raw material or a commodity or an energy dominates the bulk of your export earnings, that is something that can be pooled and controlled by an elite. And they usually come up with some excuse. So that happens a lot. That's the resource or oil curse that people talk about. What I think we need to do, and it's actually something my company's doing with the Kurdistanis in northern Iraq, and it was an attempt that ExxonMobil made with the pipeline in Chad, you need to kind of create a closed loop where, in effect, countries pay for their infrastructure development that diversifies their economy by kind of forward selling or securitizing their assets in the ground. You want to make it a closed loop so it goes straight out of the ground into the hands of the infrastructure builders so they build the infrastructure that diversifies the economy. Because if it goes into the pockets of the leadership, then maybe some of it actually goes to the infrastructure provider, and usually not much development happens.
Thomas PM Barnett is the author of The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century, also Blueprint for Action. He's a strategic planner who has worked in national security affairs since the end of the Cold War and has operated his own consulting practice since 1998. Since 2005, he's worked as a senior managing director at Intera Solutions. And he is the author of a new book called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush, published by Putnam. Thank you so much, Dr. Barnett, for being with us today.
Always good to be here.